Pushkin.
I've interviewed many successful people over the years, and one thing I find fascinating is many of them don't consider themselves business savvy. Take the owners of Tight Knit Brewing. They turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards, and do all of it in one place with the Chase mobile app. And that's helped these brew-loving friends turn a passion into a business. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JP Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
From Pushkin Industries, this is Deep Background, the show where we explore the stories behind the stories in the news. I'm Noah Feldman. Welcome to this week's episode, where we will discuss Saudi Arabia, one of the most complicated and most interesting places in the entire world. Also, one of the most opaque. Saudi Arabia's history is little understood outside of the kingdom, but it's hugely important for understanding what's going on there right now. Saudi Arabia looms very, very large in U.S. consciousness. It started in the 1970s when oil was everybody's focus. It rose during the first Gulf War, and then it peaked in the years immediately after September 11th. Since then, Saudi Arabia has never been entirely out of the news, but it has become an especially intense focus of scrutiny and interest during the Trump administration. And that's because of the close relationship between the new dominant crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's called for short, and the Trump administration. You'll remember that Donald Trump made a well-publicized visit to Saudi Arabia in the spring of 2017. That was the one with the eerie, creepy crystal ball. And he showed his great closeness to the government then. This week, Trump authorized a small troop deployment to the country after airstrikes hit a major oil processing plant there. Saudi Arabia says that Iran was behind the attack, a charge that Iran denies. Meanwhile, domestically, an internal revolution of sorts, a quiet revolution, if you will, has been happening inside of Saudi Arabia. This is a transformation both in social mores, with women suddenly able to drive, and simultaneously in political power, with a traditional Saudi royal elite family gradually giving way to a single overarching figure, MBS himself. To discuss the complex personality of Mohammed bin Salman, the history of U.S.-Saudi relations, and the revolutionary developments going on right now in Saudi Arabia, I am thrilled to have with me here in the studio Bernard Haykel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He says that to truly understand Saudi Arabia, you actually have to start by considering the country's climate.
It is absolutely one of the driest places in the world, and in fact, one of the harshest ecologies in the world. And I think one way to understand Saudi culture is that historically, it was an adaptation to that ecology.
Fascinating. Tell me about that adaptation and how it connects to how Saudi Arabia was governed for really the last couple of hundred years, since around the time of the American Revolution.
Right. So because it was a very harsh ecology, you had the principal form of social organization was tribal. And tribes are organized around, you know, an eponym, a grandfather, and often are in conflict with one another over material resources.
So an eponym means we are the tribe of so-and-so.
That's right. We're descendants of you know, Muhammad bin someone. Mm-hmm. And typically a tribe is also named after an ancestor. Mm-hmm. So these tribes were often feuding mm-hmm. over resources. And the Wahhabis arose in a world in which you had a lot of violence of that kind. And it was a religious revivalist movement that basically tried to bring order and stability and create a state to control and tamp down the nomadic, the violent impulse of the nomads.
So around 250 years ago, in this environment of nomadism with no central state, this religious revival movement, Wahhabism, comes into existence.
Right.
Named for Ibn Abdul Wahhab himself. It's his name.
That's right. It's named after a religious reformer who was a kind of, you can think of him as a Calvin, if you like, mm-hmm. Or a Luther of his day, mm-hmm. who basically said, you know, that true Islam is not practiced. People have deviated from the belief in the one true God. Mm-hmm. And in the name of God's oneness, the doctrine of God's oneness, I'm going to impose the true faith on everyone. And I'll use the sword, if necessary, to do so.
So how did this religious reform movement marry itself into a political state?
So the religious reformer himself made a pact with a local leader of a town and essentially said, you know, if you mobilize your resources in the name of this religious ideology, I will give you legitimacy. And then they started preaching and fighting and soon began to acquire other territory and bringing other territory under their power until around 1805, when they captured Mecca and Medina, and much of modern-day Arabia came under their influence.
And the name of the man with whom Ibn Abdul Wahhab made this deal was?
Muhammad ibn Saud.
And so there is the birth of the name Saudi Arabia.
That's right.
It's a guy.
Ibn Saud is a guy.
I often say to people, there are not many countries in the world that are named the Arabia of somebody in particular. Saudi Arabia means the Arabia that belongs to the family of Saud.
That's right. And in fact, the country owes its existence to their religio-military efforts to unite this entire territory.
So the birth of Saudi Arabia happens, again, right around the time of the American Revolution, and it grows out of this close alliance between the religious reformer and Wahhabism and the Saudi family and the government that grows out of that. So the modern Saudi states, in their various iterations for the last 200 years, are all reflections of that unique marriage.
And in fact, you know, that's why what's happening today is somewhat remarkable, because we see that alliance between a religious movement and a political family, mm-hmm. a dynasty, coming somewhat apart, or at least being reconfigured.
How has the relationship between the religious dynasty, because it's been a couple hundred years, and the political dynasty traditionally operated until this most recent generation?
Right. So this Saudi history and the Saudi states have had three different iterations. Mm-hmm. So you had the first Saudi state, which was founded on this pact in 1744 and lasted until 1818 when it was crushed by the Ottomans. Then there was a second Saudi state, which was less powerful, less influential in the 19th century, didn't go very far. And then we are now in the third Saudi state. And this third Saudi state was initiated by one of the descendants of the founder, Muhammad ibn Saud. He's known as King Abdulaziz, otherwise known as Ibn Saud as well. And he began the unification through the use of this religious ideology and violence of the modern Saudi state, which was ultimately declared a kingdom in 1932, and he became a king. But he allied with this family, this religious family of the reformer.
Traditional alliance, and he went back to it.
That's right. He went back to it. He mobilized a religious ideology and forces to bring other territories under his control. This started around 1902. By 1932, we have the creation of modern Saudi Arabia.
And amazingly, he did not do this on the suspicion that there was oil wealth waiting to be found.
Yeah, not at all.
As though by direct divine providence,
right,
shortly after the state was consolidated, boom, they find oil.
That's right. Lo and behold, you know, the largest oil fields in the world are in Saudi Arabia. One of them, for instance, called Ghawar, is the size of Delaware.
And the oil field is the size of
Delaware. That's right. And it has been pumping, you know, close to 5 million barrels for the last 50 some years.
With, I mean, no end in immediate sight. Eventually no. It will end.
Yes.
And that's part of what we'll talk about.
Yes. But, you know, this is, you know, the Saudi Arabia has about 23% of the world's proven oil reserves. And it is the cheapest
number.
And it's the cheapest oil to produce in the world as well. I mean, you know, it just literally almost comes out of the ground with minimal effort. Right.
Yeah.
With minimal effort.
So this extraordinary thing happens in which what was otherwise a kind of minor kingdom in an area that most countries had never bothered with,
yes,
suddenly became one of the most valuable pieces of real estate in the world because it's sitting on these oil resources.
Yes.
I would have imagined that when that happened, the ruler would have tacked away from his alliance with the religious authorities and just gone in on his own. But that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Why? Why didn't it happen?
Well, I mean, to understand King Abdulaziz Ibn Saud, you have to understand that the man, I think, had several qualities, the most important of which is that he knew the limits of his own power, and he knew that his population was deeply conservative, in fact, religiously quite reactionary, and that he needed religion in order to control his population. There's an apocryphal saying, I think it's apocryphal, but it's perfectly in keeping with his temperament and right. his character, which says that religion, he is meant to have said, religion is like a falcon. The one who controls it hunts with it. So he understood the power of religion, you know, very, very well.
So King Abdulaziz creates this dynasty, and then he does a kind of remarkable thing. He had an enormous number of sons, right?
Yes.
Not quite 100, but in that
No, he had
ballpark.
About 34, 35 sons.
34, 35 sons.
And then an equal number of daughters.
And he set things up so that the inheritance of his royal throne would not just go from father to son, father to son, father to son, as many sort of Game of Thrones-ish regimes
yes.
do it, but rather in a kind of somewhat unusual model
yes.
where it went to one of his older sons.
Right.
And then it was supposed to go down through the brothers.
That's right.
I've always been curious about this. It's such an unusual way of doing things, and it's been so crucial to the history of Saudi Arabia. How do they come up with this mechanism of designating heirs?
I mean, I think that first of all, it's not a super formalized system. Okay,
yeah. So it can be more about how it works.
It can be changed, and it is being changed now.
Yeah, we're coming to the revolution.
That's right.
Any moment now.
Right. So the first thing to understand also is that the creation of Saudi Arabia was not just the work of King Abdulaziz. It was also the creation of some of his sons who were very close in age to him. I mean, many of them had fought these battles themselves.
With him, because they were born when he was pretty young.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so the idea that somehow you could sideline these people who were the founding fathers of the kingdom was deemed untenable. So it was determined that the most competent, the most eligible of the sons would become the king by consensus and acclamation of the other brothers. And the government was divvied up between the brothers. So you had different ministries under the control of different brothers, each one of which became sort of almost like a semi-autonomous statelet, if you like, within the state. So one guy controlled the Ministry of the Interior, another person was the governor of a large province, a third was in charge of the foreign ministry, and so on.
Though they like to use a non-brother for the Ministry of Oil, right?
That's right. For
too important.
That's right. For the kind of crown jewels of the system, and there are really two. One is the oil company, Saudi Aramco. That's always been run by a technocrat, and princes were kept away in order not to mess it up. And the other is the central bank, or what is called the Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency. That's always been run also by a technocrat. So they divvied up power between themselves. You know, it became a gerontocracy. It became a country that was increasingly ruled by very old people.
Because the brothers got older and
that's
older.
That's right. The brothers got older and older, and they stayed on, you know, in positions of power, some of them for 40, 50 years as ministers in different agencies of the government. And as a result, you had the consequences of that politically, that people, as they got older, didn't want to change things. It's a place that's extremely conservative to begin with. So to understand MBS also, you have to understand that he comes out of a system that was essentially run by extremely old people who were unwilling to change how the country, how the country was run.
So as the brothers get, even if the youngest of the brothers gets older and older, any observer inside and outside can tell that at some point they're going to have to switch away from the brothers.
That's right.
Now set the stage for the current day and the rise of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman? Where does he stand, first of all, generationally compared to Abdulaziz bin Saud?
You know, I mean, he is the grandson mm-hmm. of the founder king, mm-hmm. but the grandfather died in 1953, mm-hmm. and he's still in his early 30s mm-hmm. today. And he was born around 1980, I believe.
But his father, who yes. is still, let us not forget, the king of Saudi Arabia, King Salman, is the son.
Yes, he's the son of the founder.
So we're still, technically speaking,
yes.
we're still on the sons
That's
of
right.
the original founder. We're not quite done yet.
That's right. And what happened is, as things do happen, people die. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the sons have died, and many of the principal architects of the system have passed away. King Salman is one of the last great sons and of the founder mm-hmm. and one of the great pillars of the system. He was, for instance, the governor of the largest province, the province of Riyadh, for, you know, many decades. Mm-hmm. He was the enforcer of the family's discipline. He was the keeper of the history of the family and of the kingdom. He's, you know, he's a formidable person, the present King Salman. He decided that we're going to move away from this old system of brothers and consensus to one of primogeniture, where, you know, his
son
will become. Although not, he chose not to choose his eldest son.
Why not? What was wrong with the eldest son?
It's not clear. Mm-hmm. It's not clear why he chose Muhammad bin Salman, MBS. MBS is the son of the third wife, is the eldest of the children of the third wife mm-hmm. of the king. And, you know, there are rumors as to why. One is that he saw in him mm-hmm. something that he didn't see in the other sons. You know, going back to a Saudi saying, again, to do with Falcon.
Good to have sayings. Yeah. And good with another Falcon.
Again,
good.
To another Falcon.
Falcon number two.
Yes, another Falcon saying. In Saudi Arabia, they say that the father is the falconer of his sons. Mm-hmm. In other words, the father knows which of his sons is the best hunting falcon. Mm-hmm. And so it seems that he has chosen, I mean, clearly he has chosen MBS as the best of the falcons.
I don't think I should tell my kids that I am your falconer. I don't know how well that would go over, but it makes sense.
Yes.
Okay, so the stage is now set. King Salman says, we're changing the order. Instead of it going to one of my brothers, and there are a handful of them left, I am going to designate my son, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, as the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. He is going to get the throne. He's going to be the first king of Saudi Arabia who is not either of modern Saudi Arabia, who's not either King Abdulaziz himself or one of his sons.
Correct.
And that leads to something of a sense of dissatisfaction among the other brothers, because he's breaking the chain of succession.
Yes.
He's breaking all the rules. And in response, MBS has to take decisive action involving the Ritz-Carlton
yes.
Hotel. So
yes.
tell us this perspective, what was going on?
So I think, you know, to understand the Ritz, you have to understand also that this is an absolutist monarchy, an mm-hmm. absolute monarchy.
Yep.
So the king has final say in all matters. And this king is king, while all the key brothers who would have in the past stood in his way, tried, you know, whose views mattered are no longer around.
Right, who were supposed to, but they were also, so the older brothers who were dead are gone.
The older, most senior ones right. are gone. Yep. So
he had more room for maneuver.
He had much more room for maneuver. He's an absolute monarch. And everyone in Saudi Arabia ultimately looks to the king. Mm-hmm. So the king's will, just like in the case of Louis XIV, right. is final and will determine the nature of succession. Now, what MBS does is he also sees a system that is incredibly corrupt, in which many princes, but also businessmen and bureaucrats and administrators are involved in all kinds of schemes where, you know, the government gets overcharged on contracts, all kinds of kickbacks take place. Mm-hmm. And MBS wants to show that there's a new sheriff in town and that old system is no longer going to function. And, you know, feeding at the trough, you know, where the government is paying 10 to 20% extra just because of this corruption on all its contracts is going to stop. So he has this arrest of hundreds of people, many of them princes.
Mm-hmm. So these are his cousins.
Cousins, uncles.
Uncles.
And he, you know, he has them, you know, put in, as well as bureaucrats, as well as businessmen, you know, mm-hmm. all the entire kind of elite mm-hmm. that manage the system gets put into the Ritz-Carlton. And here in the West, everyone saw this as a shakedown for MBS to benefit personally from the money. When I asked around about like, well, is he trying to enrich himself?
Yeah.
And one Saudi said, but you know, he controls the river of money. I mean, he is in charge. You know, he is the power.
He is the state.
He is
basically
the state. So he doesn't need to enrich himself. He can like take any money he wants from the state already. So it's not, it's
it
not
wasn't a shakedown. It was something else.
It was something else.
And what was it?
So I think it was two things. One was to destroy that older system of corruption. And perhaps create a new one with him at the center.
Right, a centralized
system you know, or a much smaller one. But certainly kind of a change in hierarchy and power. And it was about getting some of that money back into the public treasury. And I think he managed to do some of that if the money was in country. The money that was overseas was almost impossible to bring back.
And according to reports, they weren't gentle, even with very senior members of the royal family.
Yeah, it's possible. You know, firstly, you have to remember that any senior member of the royal family has never confronted a situation where someone says to them, you can't have this, or you can't, you can't, you know.
Much less you can't leave your suite.
That's right.
Right.
So I think, so I do think there was coercion that was used of different kinds.
Yeah.
I have no proof that torture was used, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Right.
And it's clear that it was very effective.
Yeah. So, as Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, consolidates power, he's also trying to change something about the authority of religion at the same time.
Yes.
So we hear about women driving, which is something that the traditional religious scholars have been blocking for many, many years. How is he doing that? And how real is that? You know, sometimes critics say, well, Mohammed bin Salman needs to be liked abroad. He needs support from the Trump administration in order to consolidate power.
Yes.
So he's throwing the West some bones by saying, oh, we'll liberalize for women, we'll let them drive, but there's still a guardianship system in the country where women, in theory, can't travel or, you know, make important life decisions without the agreement of a male guardian. So it's all superficial. Talk about, A, what he's doing, and B, how real it is.
So I think, again, to understand the changes that he's effecting, you have to understand the relationship that the Saudi state had with religion. And for that, to understand that, you have to go back to the Cold War. So during the Cold War, the Saudis were under immediate threat from other ideologies, namely communist ideology, socialism, Arab nationalism from Egypt, from Syria, and so on. And coups were taking place where military officers were toppling dynastic monarchies in Libya, in Iraq, almost anywhere and everywhere in the Middle East.
It was a bad period for kings in the Middle
East. That's right. And so the Americans, who were at war with, in a Cold War against the communists, basically come to the Saudis in the late 1950s under President Eisenhower and say to the Saudis, you know, why don't you mobilize Islam as a political ideology against the left? And initially the Saudis...
So we're doing In God We Trust, why don't you guys try the same?
That's right. And the Saudis initially didn't have the wherewithal and the resources to do this. They would have liked to, but it's only in the 60s when a lot of the Muslim brothers who are members of an Islamist organization are being persecuted and discriminated against in countries like Egypt, Syria, and Iraq, end up seeking refuge in Arabia, that the Saudis have the manpower, the human capital, to start using Islam as a political ideology against their ideological opponents.
Outside the country.
Outside the country.
They'd always used it internally, but they didn't have the manpower. Yeah. They didn't have the educated, skillful people move through the Arab world spreading their message.
And it became, you know, absolutely central to how Saudi Arabia defended itself. And in fact, it got ramped up at the end of the 1970s with the Iranian Revolution, which was also an Islamic revolution and sought to undermine Saudi legitimacy. So the Saudis turned up the volume on Islam as a political ideology and as patrons of this ideology. So this is a kind of a Cold War story. It's also a story of confronting Iran. And of course, with the Cold War, the culmination of that alliance with the US using Islam as an ideology was in Afghanistan. And that ended up producing Al-Qaeda, which is an unintended consequence. So MBS, against this background, MBS says, you know, this alliance with Islamists using Islam as a, you know, has brought us nothing but grief. It produced Al-Qaeda. The Americans are now blaming us for it when, in fact, we were allies with the Americans. And so I don't want to have anything to do with it. I want to just give up Islamism completely. And moreover, it's creating a society here in Saudi Arabia where no foreigner wants to come and work here. Mm-hmm. And I want to be like Dubai. I want to be dynamic. I want to create a knowledge economy. I want, you know, people to want to come here. And for that to happen, I need to socially liberalize. I need for women to be in the workplace. I need to perhaps allow for alcohol to be consumed. And I need a lot more kind of live and let live, mm-hmm. which, you know, is impossible under the old dispensation. Mm-hmm. And so I'm breaking with that past.
So on that view, we don't even need to ask so much whether MBS is throwing a bone to the West. It's the opposite. It's that it's in MBS's actual interest to weaken religious authorities. So when he does something like allow women to drive, it's not necessarily that he cares so much about women inherently. It's that he's trying to produce a more, westernized is too strong a term, but a more liberalized society to help himself and to help his economy.
Yeah, I mean, not politically liberal at all. But, right. you know, something...
Sorry, yeah, not liberal in the sense of letting anybody yes. vote. That's not on yeah. the cards.
No. I think something like... I mean, what he wants is to replace Islam with nationalism and populism. He mm-hmm. wants something similar to, let's say, Russia or China, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of a political model, where Saudis care about being, you know, Saudis and don't care about Wahhabism and don't want to spend money on building mosques overseas and that sort of thing. So he's interested in changing the very kind of nature of society and the allegiances of people.
So that's the attractive might be the wrong word, but that's the kind of defensible, reasonable, understandable reformist face, as it were, of MBS. And yet at the same time, he's come to be seen internationally as being very brutal in the process of doing this. And a crucial event in this was the murder of someone whom we both knew, Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi himself from a prominent Saudi family. Super upsetting to many people who knew Jamal, like,
yes.
like you and me. Talk a little bit about why that happened and how we can try to make sense of it in light of the other objectives that Mohammed bin Salman is pursuing.
So I think, you know, Jamal represented in a way the old order. And Jamal himself, as you said, I knew him. I've invited him to Princeton and he's spoken there and I've known him since the late 1990s. And but Jamal was seen as an Islamist mm-hmm. by the regime and he was seen as closer to Erdogan in Turkey and to the Qataris, and that he wanted, unlike MBS, for that alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood to be maintained, that Saudi Arabia could not reform politically or socially without that alliance with the Islamists.
It's a longer story for another conversation maybe we can have in the future. People, especially in the U.S., hear the word Islamist and think that that's somebody who is a jihadi or a radical, but that's often not the case. And it was certainly not the case for Jamal. He's more part of a trend of the last quarter century where many members of the Muslim Brotherhood came to embrace at least some of the goals of democracy.
Yes.
And wanted to democratize a place like Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And liked the aspiration, it hasn't worked out so well in Turkey, but the aspiration at least of a democratic regime that was still Islamic in its orientation.
Yes.
And, you know, lots of people thought that's what should happen in Egypt after the Arab Spring. It didn't work out so well there either. But so it's just important to clarify that what might have looked like a threat to Mohammed bin Salman might not have been a threat when viewed from the standpoint, say, of democracy.
Yes, absolutely correct. And Jamal basically wanted Saudi Arabia to become more democratic. Yeah. And that clashed with MBS's vision of the strong man who's going to use nationalism and populism and move away from Islamism.
Then why, to be blunt, why murder him instead of just letting him become what he already was, a vocal critic from the outside, essentially in exile?
My sense is that he was seen as a real threat because he could mobilize all the dissidents around the world against Saudi Arabia. He was very effective at using social media. He had a platform in the Washington Post. And I suspect that people around MBS went to him and said, basically, this guy is, you know, a real menace, a real threat to the order that you're trying to establish, and we should get rid of him.
The murder, in addition to being morally reprehensible, was a gross miscalculation.
Yes.
It backfired hugely with the international community, especially journalists and academics, the kind of people whom Jamal knew all over the world, really turning on MBS in a way that at an emotional level, I experience as hard to get beyond myself.
Yes.
You know, I myself feel frustrated with him, angry at him because he killed my friend.
Yes.
You know,
the people around him were so arrogant because of their success domestically at taming all dissidents and opposition that they felt that they can do this also overseas. And I think that people definitely in the kingdom around MBS and he himself feels that it was a mistake vis-a-vis the West. I'm not sure, though, if you're looking at Saudi dissidents around the world, and if you can show that you can get one of them in Turkey under the rule of Erdogan, who is the personal friend of that dissident, mm-hmm. if you can get to that guy, mm-hmm. you can get to almost anyone.
So the message to the rest of the dissidents is, we can get you no matter where you are. You can't run. You can't
hide. A kind of Putin-like message, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. to dissidents. So, you know,
they might not regret it in that regard.
Maybe not.
With the blowback.
Yes, maybe not.
Say a little bit about MBS himself. And you know him.
Yes. As I work in Saudi Arabia, I knew a number of people who were around him, mm-hmm. around MBS. And one of them once contacted me and said, you know, the prince has seen a piece that you've written and would like to meet with you. This was a time when he was trying to cultivate Americans, mm-hmm. and American elites. And so I met with him and, you know, we chatted in Arabic. And my impression of him is that he, you know, he's very charismatic. Mm-hmm. He has facts and figures, you know, at his fingertips about all kinds of things. So there's kind of like a, you know, a genius-like quality in that he can give you like rattle off numbers and data about almost anything to do with the kingdom. And then he also pays real close attention to what you're saying. So he gives you the feeling that, you know, he really cares. So he's a politician's politician.
And a skilled one, it sounds.
And a very
like.
Skilled one.
Comes across as very impressive.
Yeah, and he's, you know.
You can see how he impressed the Trump administration.
That's right. And he charmed also, you know, Michael Bloomberg and mm-hmm. all kinds of people, you know, around the country. Tom Friedman, you know, David Ignatius, mm-hmm. all kinds of people mm-hmm. were charmed
people,
by him.
Many of whom are skeptical people in general.
That's right. And, you know, I think he had the advantage of the fact that he was so different from these older rulers of Saudi Arabia who just seemed like, you know, clones of these old Soviets. You know, you remember in the old days with Andropov and Brezhnev and mm-hmm. all these guys, mm-hmm. you know, the Politburo who just seemed like dead men walking,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
dead men walking. Yeah. And he is just a breath of fresh air in the sense that he talks and wants to change and wants to liberalize and so on. So there's a kind of attractive quality to him because mm-hmm. of that. But at the same time, there's a toughness to him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually probably why he was chosen by his dad.
How do you, as someone who's an observer of the region, a scholar of the region, how do you internally balance and find your own ethical compass in dealing with somebody who is in many ways dynamic, extraordinary, a genuine reformer, and also capable of, you know, dropping a dime and killing somebody?
So, you know, he's an object of research for me. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, I go to the Middle East and I go to Saudi Arabia and I talk to people who hate him mm-hmm. inside the royal family, mm-hmm. dissidents, you know, ex-jihadists, journalists, liberals, women. And he's just one of the mm-hmm. many people that I mm-hmm. engage with to learn as much as I can about the country. Mm-hmm. And so I think of my engagement with him in as much as it will continue mm-hmm. as just part of research, mm-hmm. you know. Now, if he asks me, you know, what do I think about X or Y, just tell him what I think, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So I haven't sort of held back on telling him that, you know, killing Jamal is a terrible thing and mm-hmm. it's a crime and someone should pay for it. Mm-hmm. I haven't stopped from telling him that, you know, if he tries to build an alliance with the Chinese or the Russians and move away from the West, that would be a terrible strategic error for his country. I tell him that, you know, the dissidents should be released, all dissidents, not just the women, because, you know, writing in social media criticism is not criminal mm-hmm. and will never be understood as criminal in the West.
And I mean, I've had this experience myself, so I'm not asking you something that I haven't asked myself 1,000 times as well. But what do you say when people tell you, look, that's all well and good to think of someone as an object of research. But if you're in conversation, you know, if you're having late night text exchange with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, you know, you're helping him in some way. You're engaged with power. And if you're giving him good advice, that's good advice that he'll use to achieve his ends, whatever they are. And so that that line drawing, which is very hard for any engaged scholar to do, is too hard to defend against and better to keep a distance. What do you say when people say that to you?
I mean, I think that as long as I feel that I haven't done something wrong or helped him do something wrong, mm-hmm. which I haven't done,
yeah,
I don't feel compromised.
Yeah,
I mean, if he asks me to do something, that's a different matter.
I mean, right? I should say for myself, I have felt compromised. You know, leave aside Mohammed bin Salman. You know, I worked with the U.S. government in Iraq, working on the constitutional process there, and you know, I had then and still have lots of criticisms of the way the United States government operated. But I was, you know, I was fully part of a U.S. occupation regime, and the ethical errors and the crimes that you know, government backed, you know, that the United States committed there, I have to bear some ethical obligation and responsibility for them. Yeah. But that's a little different because that's my own country, and you're talking
right.
To somebody
and also
not your
you
country.
Accept. I mean, you also agreed to, you know, in a formal capacity to take a job,
totally right?
So I'm not taking
totally
a job.
Different. Yeah,
I'm not taking a job. I mean, for me, it's a way of understanding the system so much more and the country so much better.
Yeah, yeah. Just to close, where's it all going? You know, revolutions look impressive when they're going well. So this revolution seems to be succeeding. What are the risks and what are your predictions about whether it will ultimately succeed?
Right. So for me, the idea of success here is whether Saudi Arabia will be able to transition to an economy that is prosperous and that delivers for its people beyond the age of oil.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially what you have in Saudi Arabia is a nanny state that uses the oil revenues and then redistributes it to the population. And that's an unsustainable model. And it also creates certain pathologies in terms of people expecting jobs from the government, not wanting to work in the private sector and so on. So I think the economic challenge is the most serious one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, doubtful as to whether that's possible in Saudi Arabia or anywhere else, given the volume of money that gets generated and gets redistributed.
Mm-hmm.
I should add one last thing, which is that if he doesn't deliver, if MBS doesn't deliver on his promises of economic reform
mm-hmm.
and eventually of political reform, there will be social mobilization. People will mobilize in the streets mm-hmm. like they have in Egypt and in other
mm-hmm.
places
mm-hmm.
and will make demands for greater accountability, greater participation in the government.
Well, when that starts to happen, we'll have you back and we'll talk about it. Bernie, thank you so much for a fascinating, fascinating conversation. I look forward to talking more with you about these things, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us on Deep Background again.
Thank you.
What does it mean for the future of U.S.-Saudi relations that the United States has deployed troops to Saudi Arabia for the first time in years? Does that decision increase the chances of a broader war in the Middle East? Well, one thing is for certain. U.S.-Saudi relations, close for more than half a century, are getting closer by the day. Donald Trump sees Saudi Arabia as the linchpin in a broader regional alliance against Iran. Israel agrees with that position, and Donald Trump has worked hard to try to bring the Saudis and the Israelis closer together, again, on the axis of being against Iran. Saudi oil remains crucial to the economy of Europe and therefore by extension to the broader oil markets, even as the amount of oil the U.S. produces has gone up. And as long as the world remains dependent on oil, Saudi Arabia is going to remain a crucial strategic player. That means the U.S.-Saudi relationship is likely to stay close even if someone else replaces Donald Trump as president of the United States. Over time, if Saudi Arabia actually reforms under Mohammed bin Salman, that is likely to bring the Saudis and the Americans closer still together. Of course, closeness between countries like the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is not necessarily the same thing as the United States going to war on behalf of the Saudis. Right now, we know the Saudis don't want war with Iran. The Israelis don't want war with Iran. And Donald Trump doesn't want war with Iran. So for the moment, expect the relationship between the Saudis, the Israelis, and the Americans to get deeper, but watch closely to see if Saudi Arabia is able to make the internal reforms that will strengthen its ties to the United States.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now for our very remarkable sound of the week.
The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections. Therefore, today, I'm announcing the House of Representatives moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry.
That, of course, was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Tuesday announcing that an impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump is going to go forward. There's no way to avoid the sense that we are at a historic moment in the history of the United States. It's not that we haven't had impeachment inquiries before. Andrew Johnson was impeached, but ultimately not convicted by the Senate. The same was true for Bill Clinton. Richard Nixon never got to the point of being impeached because he quit. But that is a tiny number of instances where the House of Representatives has come to the point where it is preparing to issue articles of impeachment against a sitting president. What's most remarkable about this instance and what differentiates it from the previous three examples is that this time it's all about interactions between the president of the United States and foreign powers. That's how it started with the Mueller investigation, but it seemed when that investigation came to an end that Donald Trump had somehow dodged the bullet, that he had managed to emphasize the part of the Mueller report that said there was not sufficient evidence of collusion in the 2016 campaign between him and the Russians, and to de-emphasize the parts of the report that emphasized obstruction of justice. What's changed is the revelation that a phone conversation occurred between Trump and Volodymyr Zelenko, the president of Ukraine, in which Trump actively requested, as a favor, Trump's word, for the president of Ukraine to commence an investigation of Joe Biden, who, not by coincidence, is Donald Trump's leading opponent going into the 2020 campaign. What would it mean in historical terms for the House of Representatives to impeach a president for effectively asking the assistance of a foreign power to subvert our democratic elections? The answer is that if proven, such allegations amount to a serious attempt to undercut the independence and sovereignty of the United States as a republic of its own. To be very clear, we are not talking here merely about an attempt within the United States to distort electoral outcomes. We're not talking about breaking into the Democratic National Committee's headquarters the way Richard Nixon had the Watergate burglars do. No, we are talking about calling on an outside power to take some role in attempting to affect the outcome of the U.S. election. Remarkably and astonishingly, the current allegation is that Donald Trump, in fact, attempted to do, using Ukraine, what there was not evidence that he did with Russia, namely to collude with them in a process designed to affect the outcome of a U.S. election. And this time, we're finding out about it before the election's even taken place. Now, there's a lot more to find out about the details, and there are sure to be denials by Donald Trump and by Republicans. There's no guarantee that Trump will be impeached, and there's no guarantee that if he is impeached, he will be removed by the Senate. Indeed, that seems like it would be a very tough road to travel. Nevertheless, the mere fact of the allegations, coupled with the opening of the impeachment inquiry, signals that we are at a remarkable, unusual, indeed astounding moment in U.S. history. If you ask me what would the founding fathers have said, I think they would have looked at us and said, we warned you this could happen. We gave you an impeachment process in order to deal with it. The future of the republic is in your hands, not ours. If we mess it up, we won't be able to blame people who lived 250 years ago. It'll be on us.
Deep Background is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. Our producer is Lydia Jean Cott, with engineering by Jason Gambrell and Jason Rostkowski. Our showrunner is Sophie McKibben. Our theme music is composed by Luis Guerra. Special thanks to the Pushkin Brass, Malcolm Gladwell, Jacob Weisberg, and Mia Lobel. I'm Noah Feldman. You can follow me on Twitter at Noah R. Feldman. This is Deep Background.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.